hello, all you beautiful spirits. You are listening to WAIF Cincinnati, your favorite listener-supported radio station, 88.3 FM on your radio dial, and online at waf883.org. That intro music was It's Time for a Change by Here to Hear. WAIF, WAIF as a community radio station, serves only to open its airways to responsible, divergent points of view. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect those of WAIF, its board of trustees, its staff, or programmers. The opinions expressed on this program are my own views or those of my guest. And I want to thank everyone so much for listening today. Our show for the next 2 hours is Inner Divinity, Knowing the Source Within. And my name is Reverend Louisa Dyer. I am an interfaith and metaphysical minister, and I am your host every Wednesday here on WAIF. Our show, Inner Divinity, is focused on spirituality and personal growth because that's my passion, and it really is about knowing who we are, knowing that divine spark inside of us. And what I want to do every week is give us really practical tools to help us be more in touch with that divine nature that is inside of us that makes us actually live. Because I know that divine spark is in you and it's in me, otherwise we wouldn't be living. We start each show with a few minutes of music, and I'm going to do that here just in a moment. We're going to be doing something a little bit different today. My good friend Audrey DePue is going to be talking to me today about my own spiritual journey, because I've been asking people to come on the radio and share their stories of aha moments, of times in their lives when something happened that, you know, really changed who they knew themselves to be, or let them really know that they do have that God inside of them. And so I've been asking people to tell their transformational stories, and they can either come in the studio and do that, or we can do that by phone. And my good friend, Reverend Audrey DePue, we told her personal story in terms of her spiritual journey a few weeks ago, and that was just beautiful. I hope you got to hear that. And last week, of course, I had on Conscious Dancer magazine and talked with Mark Metz and Tony Bergens about how dance has been such an important part of their spiritual journey. And so people were saying, what about your personal journey? So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. I tell you, my life has been a very interesting ride. Just, oh my gosh, been there, done that. I could say that to almost everything. And my spiritual journey certainly has been an interesting one. And what we do on this show every week is do our best to tap into the power and the beauty and the divine love that actually animates all forms of life, including mine and yours. Because you know what? If you didn't have that God spark inside of you, or if I didn't, then we wouldn't be living. So when we can actually learn to welcome that, we begin to wake up to the beauty, to the glory, just to the love that's in life itself. Okay, so let me see if I've got Miss Audrey on the right mic here. Hey, Miss Audrey, how you doing?
And so I'm delighted to be
there.
Yes, this afternoon.
We are happy to be here. This is interesting because I am like running the show, and usually when I'm running the show and I'm doing an interview, then I'm in charge of everything. But now today I'm going to try to figure out how to run the show and let Audrey be in charge of the show itself. So this ought to be interesting, folks. So thank you, Audrey, for being here.
Just throw your hands up and let go.
Just throw them on up there. We'll get up there with Etta and say, this little light of mine, we're just going to let it shine. That's what we're doing here today, huh?
Yes.
Okay, good.
So, you know, the first course I took in seminary, that we had a book entitled God.
Oh, boy.
And the first chapter was The Question of God.
Oh, my.
How do I know God is real?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I would ask you that question.
Oh,
I want to know about your journey, your experience of connecting with that higher, with that source, your higher self.
Well, the answer to that question has changed a lot over my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But the first way that I knew God was real is because when I would go and sit in the woods when I was a little bitty girl, I mean literally I was toddling down the street when I was 3 years old, to go sit in the woods, which was about, oh, the equivalent of a city block, I guess, from my house. And my home life was not a lot of fun. It was very loud, and people didn't get along so well. But I could go, and I could go sit in the woods, and it was so peaceful and so obviously in order and so balanced that the feeling that I had inside of me at those times when I could just sit in the woods, there came a point where I could actually hear the trees hum. And that's when I absolutely knew for sure that God existed, when I could hear the trees hum. Because, you know, I figured out pretty quick after I'd asked two or three people about, you know, how the different trees sounded to them, and they looked at me like, yeah, right, we're going to lock you up. I realized other people weren't really hearing those trees pretty quick. But I could hear this hum, and it just, you know, many, many, many years later, I realized that it's the sound of Om, that everybody in spiritual traditions through all over the world have used that tone as a way to feel that connection. And that's what the trees humming were. And so that was probably the first place I knew that God was real, is because I could feel God in the trees, in the woods, in me, all around me. And then, unfortunately, I lost that through my life. I lost that connection, but got it back again. So if I were to answer the question today, and like I said, it would have changed periodically throughout my life. I would have had a lot of answers to that. But it's interesting because today, the answer to how do I know God is real is quite similar to that little girl, except it's not about the trees, but it's about that same vibration, I guess. That same, it's not quite a sound, but it is. It's a tone. It's a vibration that I can feel inside of me and that I can always experience if I'm sitting at the ocean or with a tree or just looking at a leaf or in church with some good singing. It's like a fullness and a vibration and a tone, and it's real. It's something that I actually experience as part of my being. And that's how I know. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the books I read in the world, I knew intellectually, but that's not the same thing as knowing.
Talk to me about the contrast between that peace and that balanced feeling in the woods with your everyday life and, of course, with your experience in church.
You mean today or as a child?
As a child. First of all, let's remind the listeners that you grew up in Asheville.
Yes, I grew up in Marion, mm-hmm. North Carolina, which is at the bottom of the mountain, okay. Up from Asheville, which is Appalachia, Western North Carolina. And I love Western North Carolina. Those mountains talk. Those mountains have got some deep, deep soul. So, yeah, I grew up in Appalachia, working class girl, long side of the tracks, the whole nine yards. And I've already forgotten your question.
So you went out in the woods and you felt the presence.
Yes.
Okay. Was that, contrast that with what you experienced in your Pentecostal church?
Oh. Well, that was a real mixed bag, that Pentecostal church. I'm very grateful to this day that my father was religious and my mother was not. Because my father was religious, extraordinarily so. He was a deacon in the Pentecostal church, and he preached, of course, at every opportunity. And now he is an evangelist and has been doing that for many, many years, and he's a minister in his own right. But when I was growing up, he was a deacon in the church. And because of that, I really started exploring the whole understanding of God at a very, very, very young age. God and the devil, good and bad. And so it has something, it's been a lifelong study for me. But the church was also an extraordinarily scary place. It was all about hellfire and damnation. It was all about shame. what I liked about the church was the singing and the music and the energy. Oh, my goodness. I think I have my enthusiasm to this day because of that early experience of what it is to be enthusiastic. Because let me tell you what, they would get up there and preach and dance and sing and roll around on the floor and speak in tongues and all of that stuff. And I really loved the energy and I loved the music, but the message was terrifying. Mm-hmm. And I also found a lot of people in the church to be hypocritical. And it really hurt my heart. The story I remember is there was this guy in church who was a hare lip. And it wasn't his, no, he had a cleft palate. I can't remember what it was now, but, you know, they all made fun of him. They didn't make fun of him to his face. Mm-hmm. Thank God. That would have really, I would have had to hurt somebody if they'd done that. But they made fun of him behind his back. And it always just, it hurt me so bad that people who would say and preach these things would then turn around and do something mean like that. But mostly it was just, to me, in the woods, God was peace. God was love. God was this vibration that was nourishing and nurturing and unconditionally loving. And in church, God was this really scary. I was way more scared of God than I was of the devil. The devil seemed like nothing compared to how bad God was. So church was really scary. And I did it. I got through it. Because I just assigned roles to myself in church. I would take care of, like when people got up to go to the altar and they would leave their little kids on the pews, I would gather up all the little kids and take them in the back and make a little corral for them so that nobody, you know, was jumping up and down on the kids. And I sang every Sunday in church, and that was a lot of fun. But, you know, I had this experience when I guess I was maybe 5 or 6 years old where I was at the altar, which I did all the time, begging and begging. I was crying so hard that I was almost in convulsions, begging and begging and begging for forgiveness because I felt so, so sinful and so bad and so horrible. And I was just like, just begging and crying for forgiveness. And I heard this voice, just as clear as a bell. This voice says, "You're just a child. What could you have possibly done to need such forgiveness for?" And I, like, stopped my crying and looked around. Like, where is that boy? Who? What? Because I knew that sure wasn't the preacher talking. And that voice pretty much just, it's like, dry your eyes and know you are loved. That's really the message here. And I get chills even now talking about it. Because that was, I felt like that was the beginning of me saying, wait a minute. All this really ugly, ugly, hateful, horrible stuff. Maybe this isn't really my path to God. It's like that, I really remember how that woke me up because I did. I dried my tears and I went outside and I sat and I thought about that. Like, wow, what if it's just about being loved? So anyway, that was the beginning of me waking up and realizing that church at that point was not what was good for me, that more being in the woods was good for me. Mm-hmm. Because I was really an unhappy, very miserable, very sad child. I later learned through a lot of study that I had what's called existential angst, and no child should really have to deal with a lot of existential angst. And so I was really, really distressed about that as a child, and I couldn't square what I knew, because I learned to read very early. And so I had read the Bible. I had practically memorized the Bible. And I couldn't square what it said in the Old Testament with what it said in the New Testament. To me, they seemed really contradictory. Mm-hmm. And so I would go to all the church people and say, explain this to me, which is true. And if both of them are true, how can they both be true? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. And I got in lots of trouble. Lots and lots and lots of trouble. Because I wasn't supposed to question. I was supposed to have faith. I wasn't supposed to question anything. And that also really upset me because I have a very questioning mind. I have a very analytical intellect. It's like I want to know. I want to know everything. And that was not okay. Mm-hmm. So I guess the difference is in the woods I felt peaceful and in church I felt scared.
Mm-hmm. You know, you brought up an interesting point because many of us grew up in churches where we were taught by people who themselves had never really studied the scripture. They had not studied theology. They did not understand the ancient religion that we, you know, that was handed down to us, and they didn't understand the social, the historical, and the cultural foundation of the words that were in this holy book.
Right.
So if you don't know that, if you try to put a 20th century interpretation on something that you're reading, and you don't understand, and you don't know the history of the narratives and the symbols and the rituals and the songs and the witness that's in that scripture, then you're going to be off when you try to teach somebody. And I realize that also. But the thing that bothers me is that it's still happening.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's still people who don't know that if you pick up a book that was written, well, the King James Version was published in 1603. Okay, so you pick up a book that was written back in Middle English and Old English.
Which was translated from the Latin, from the Greek, from the Aramaic. I mean, how many losses of translation do we have?
It's just like picking up a Shakespearean play.
Uh-huh.
And trying to read that. Because I'm an English major, and in my Shakespeare book, my first course in Shakespeare, the book, the page was divided. On one side was Shakespeare's words. On the other side were all kinds of notes to try to explain to you what those words meant, why the people might have laughed at this particular thing. And there's no way you can read Shakespeare without reading those notes. And the scripture is the same way.
Uh-huh.
And many people don't get a chance to have that experience of what we call exegeting the scripture. So I'm glad you brought that up. And it's always, that has been one of my goals as a minister, is to share with the people in the pews what I've learned over the years.
Right.
You know, and don't let them pick up the book and have nothing to relate those words to, no understanding of who wrote it, to whom were they writing, how did the people who heard this, how did they interpret it, and how they understand it.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I just have to say that I've been wanting to write a book for at least 10 years since I discovered the Aramaic translation. What's the guy's name? This guy devoted his life to translating the supposedly the original Aramaic text that the Bible was written in, both the Old and the New Testaments. I think it was called a Peshitta in that language. And he devoted his life to translating that directly from Aramaic into English. And it's called the Aramaic version, whatever. Laszlo, Lamzo, gosh, I can't remember his name. But anyway, when I first read that, especially when I read the New Testament, I was so stunned to see the same things that had terrified me, because the message was so garbled and so filled with fear when I was a kid. And I read that, and I was so inspired and so excited. But at that moment, I decided I want to write a book that's called Jesus Said. And I want to just have a book that actually talks about what Jesus taught. Because I'll tell you, what I got taught in childhood was not what Jesus taught. That, mm-hmm. that was just not what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right. I think it's been 2,000 years already. If we were actually as a species, as a race, as a human race, using the words that Jesus taught, we would be in a really different place. We haven't started doing that yet.
Mm-hmm.
We're still just barely scratching the surface of actually doing. Anyway, I don't want to get off on that whole topic, but
well, I think it's important.
Yeah.
Your show is called Inner Divinity, Knowing the Source Within. And one of the things that I admire about you is that you have done your homework. You have walked this path, and you know how to, you know about the source. You've made that connection. You were saying about Jesus and the things that he taught. I was wondering, well, maybe I'll just keep going. Talk to me about, I heard that by the time you were 7 years old, you had read the whole World Book Encyclopedia. Is that true?
That is a true story. I learned to read when I was three, and my mama got really tired of me wanting her to explain everything that there was. And so she started selling World Book Encyclopedia so that she could afford to buy a set. And then every time I had a question, she would say, look it up. And then after maybe, I don't know, not too awfully long, I said, well, shucks, I'm just going to read the whole thing. And I started, because she would get one at a time, you know, because that's what she could afford. And so every time she got a new one, and found, by the time she had the whole set, I was on the last one. I mean, I just kept up with them. And, I read the whole World Book Encyclopedia set. What years was that? That was like the late 50s, early 60s. But, yeah, the same thing with the Bible. I practically had the Bible memorized. I love to read. Always love to read. Reading saved my life. I have no doubt of that. And I found, not the Old Testament. The Old Testament was really scary. I read that because I had to repeat it. But the New Testament, I pretty much had memorized as a kid. Probably the King James Version. But, yeah.
So, Jesus was a metaphysician.
The best metaphysician that we have record of at this point.
So I want you to talk to the studio audience about what that means.
Oh, wow. Metaphysical. Well, you know, that's a really wonderful, beautiful question. Thank you so much, because people are always saying, meta what? When I say metaphysical, literally, metaphysical. Meta means beyond physical. So literally, that's what it means, beyond the physical. Metaphysical, like what Jesus did, when I call myself a metaphysical minister, when people say they're studying metaphysics, what it means is that we're studying the laws that govern beyond the physical.
Mm-hmm.
The physical world, the material manifestation, is the lowest vibration that there is of things. If we can see it, touch it, taste it, feel it, then it's got a slower vibration than the stuff that is called spiritual, because that's what's spiritual. You can't see. It's beyond the physical. So when Jesus, for example, walked on water and turned water into wine and raised people from the dead and healed the sick, he was using metaphysical principles, which you could say part of is faith, if you want to talk about it in that sense. But the other part of it is it's the law. That if you know, and I've done it myself with various things. I have what some people would say stopped time. But I've proven to myself over and over, I've done it with, I've never actually walked on a bed of hot coals, but I have lots and lots of friends who have walked on beds of hot coals and didn't get burned feet at all. And I haven't done it because I don't yet believe I could, so I would never do it until I was sure that I could. But the only reason that most people would walk on a bed of hot coals and get third-degree burns on their feet, and other people could walk across a bed of hot coals and have no indication whatsoever on their feet that they had just done that, is that the people who can do that know that there is a higher law than the physical, that the physical is just a reflection of something non-physical. And so to be a metaphysician, to me, is to attempt, because I think that's all it ever is for most of us, to attempt to understand what I call spiritual laws. And there are a lot of them. And so it's not like a formula that you can say A, B, C.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people who teach about those metaphysical laws. And, you know, it's Hermes, which was, he existed, gosh, I'm trying to think, before Moses, probably in the days of Abraham. Hermes was one of the first people, what's that book called? The Kabbalion. Kabbalion? I think that's what the book is called. Where he first tried to set down some of these metaphysical principles. But basically, it's just that you can change physical reality real simply.
Mm-hmm. Let's keep going with that, because for the people who are listening today who have challenges in their lives,
mm-hmm.
who are distressed about people, places, things, or situations, circumstances, who are worried,
right.
Emotional problems. Let's talk about healing. How to heal that. using these metaphysical principles?
The most important first step always is being willing. That is, I cannot even say, if I could get on a big podium with a huge loudspeaker and say that. It's like what I find in 30 years of counseling, what I find in myself, what I hear and see all the time, is most of us, when we are suffering in whatever form that we're suffering, whether it's a physical illness or an emotional challenge, you know, an addiction, whatever. For me, my problems are usually emotional. Other people's, it's like they tend to be more physical, or they tend to be more this, that, whatever. It doesn't matter. The first thing we have to notice is, are we willing to let that go? Are we willing to give it up? Because if we weren't getting something out of it, if we didn't think we needed it, or we weren't getting something out of it, we wouldn't keep it. We would just let it go. And so the first step, and every metaphysical book and every metaphysician, including Jesus, talked about this. It's like we're beings of free will. And so the very first thing is you have to be willing to let it go. Mm-hmm. And that means you have to give up. You have to be willing to give up all the stuff you're getting from it. So, for example, with me, you know, emotional upset. Well, you know, the ego gets a lot out of emotional upset. I get attention. I get to go lay down. You know, I might even go have a drink. I mean, you know, it's like I get a lot. So the first step always in addressing any challenge is, are you willing to let it go? And if you're honest with yourself, you'll probably notice that, nah, I'm not. Because if I was, I would have done it already. And so then you notice, are you willing to be willing to let it go? And that's all you ever have to be. The moment we express willingness, literally the whole entire universe begins changing to make that so. That is a function of physics, and that has been proven, quantum physics specifically. And that's actually what Jesus says in the Bible, by your faith ye are healed. And that's really all that is the willingness to let something go is an exhibition of faith that I can, and that there's something to replace it that's going to be better. And so the first step is the willingness to let go whatever it is. And the next step is as important, is believing that you can. Believing that something could be different. Because for most of us, if we've been holding on to something long enough, or it's been holding on to us, we don't think we can let it go. It's like, we really don't think I can't get rid of that diabetes. I've had that my whole life. I can't stop being depressed. I've been depressed my whole life. I can't. Who would I be? It's my identity. So the first step is the willingness to let it go. And the second step is the willingness to believe that you're going to exist without it. So, you know what? I'm noticing the time. So we're going to play a little music for you here. And we'll be back in just a few moments. Enjoy.
We'd like to thank a soul by the name of Bob Marley for this song. What a way to celebrate your death. This song says every little thing is going to be all right. You know how much fun it is to know that? It's true that it's going to be all right. Because it's already
listening to WAIF Cincinnati 88.3 FM on your dial and live streaming online at WAIF883.org. And we started that set off with Here to Hear's remix of Bob Marley's incredible It's Gonna Be All Right. And you know what? We know it's gonna be all right because it already is all right. And that's what the boys say in the song, and I love it. I am your host every Wednesday from 1 to 3 Eastern for a show called Inner Divinity, Knowing the Source Within. My name is Reverend Louisa Dyer. I am an interfaith and metaphysical minister. And this show is really all about helping each of us discover, connect with, begin to live from the reality that we are divinely created beings. That there is that source energy. You can call that God. You can call that Great Spirit. Doesn't matter what you call it. I often just call it love. And it lives in us. It's in our hearts. It's our birthright. And we are all about claiming it here. And so I want to thank each of you for listening. And we are here every Wednesday, like I said, from 1 to 3 Eastern. And if you would like some help with getting in touch with that inner divinity for yourself, there is a free guided meditation that you can download from my website, which is my name, louisadyer.com. There's also a lot of other free tools on there that you are welcome to use. I also wanted to let everybody know that there is a Facebook page for this show, and that Facebook page is called Inner Divinity, Knowing the Source Within. And I put that up there because I would love to see more interaction between listeners. I'd love to hear people's stories. I'd love to hear what you like about the show. I'd love to hear what you want to hear about on the show. And if you have a transformational story of your own to tell about something that happened or something that you read, something that you discovered or experienced, or you just want to talk about your spiritual journey, I'd love to have you on the radio show, and we can do that. You can come in the studio, or we can do that by phone. And what we're doing today, actually, is a really good friend of mine, Reverend Audrey DePue, is talking to me about my own spiritual journey, because I had a couple of friends tell me, hey, if you want us to talk about ours, why don't you talk about yours? And so I said, okay, that is a really good idea. So Audrey and I are going to get back to that conversation in just a minute. I also want to let you know about underwriting here on WAIF. Do you have a business that you would like to underwrite on WAIF? We offer very cost-friendly rates. We can target your underwriting to any show that you choose. Just call one of our underwriting experts today at 513-351-1538 or 513-226-5585 and find out how you can get your business information to our listeners. The cost of underwriting is very affordable. WAIF will help you reach our community with your message. You'll be helping your business as well as this great radio station, WAIF 88.3, What Radio is Meant to Be. And so we are back now with Miss Audrey. How you doing over there, girl?
Well, I'm radiating.
She's radiating.
Before we took a break, we were talking about our beliefs cause our suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And you had given us, you had started telling us about your journey, and I want to go back to that.
Okay.
Because I understand that there was a period of time when you tried to be an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that miracles kept happening, and so you had to let go of that attempt to ease God out. But anyway, talk to us about that period in your life.
Well, I tried to be an atheist because, well, okay, I have to start this story by saying that I was a very miserable child, but nobody knew it. I was one of those, today I guess you would diagnose me with borderline personality disorder. If I, being the psychologist that I was, I split off from myself very early because I couldn't handle the stuff that was going on in my life. And my first suicide attempt was actually at age 10. And nobody knew about it. It was very secret, and that was part of my, that was very intentional. I didn't want anybody to know about it. I was a straight-A student. I was the life of the party. I was apparently very popular, according to everybody else. But I did not feel any of those things. I felt very alone and very, very, very sad. And I cried all the time, but it was always very, very secret. I did not let anybody know that I was actually not a happy person. So I think it would have surprised a lot of people to know that when I was a kid. But I was extraordinarily miserable because I couldn't square the peace of God that I found in the woods with what was going on in my house and what was going on in the church. And I couldn't make a difference. I couldn't be Jesus, which is what I thought I was supposed to be. I couldn't heal myself. I couldn't heal anybody in my family. I sure couldn't heal the world. And I just couldn't live with the pain of that. And so the first suicide attempt, and I had many, believe me, but the first one was at age 10, and obviously it didn't work. It was a brilliant plan, but it still didn't work. And after that, I managed to figure out a way to stop going to church, and I just got really, really, really numb. I tried to live by being numb, and I convinced myself that God wasn't real, that God didn't exist, because if God did exist, I would not be so miserable, and so would everybody else not be so miserable. And then I discovered marijuana. Marijuana sort of became my goddess. And being stoned when I was very, very young, I started when I was maybe 11 or 12, suddenly I could see God again. Suddenly I could feel nature again. Because being stoned separates you from yourself. And you can't actually experience anything. But what it did for me was it separated me from myself, meaning it separated me from my pain. And I could see what was there again. And I knew I could never feel it as long as I was stoned. But at least I knew it was there again. And so strange things happened. I made a number of suicide attempts. And sort of, not the last one, but one of the most profound ones happened when I was 19. When it was actually my third heroin overdose. And I died. I had what people call a near-death experience, which I don't understand because you do actually die. I don't know why they call it near-death. But anyway, from those years, from 12 to 19, so many miracles happened in my life. I mean, I attempted suicide a number of times. There were brilliant plans. None of them worked. Every time they didn't work, it was a miracle. Once, after a suicide attempt, and I had run away from home and come back, and my father attempted to set some rules that I knew I wasn't going to be able to follow. And I was just going to kill myself again, and I was devising a new plan. In walks this man and his wife, who I had only met. He was a minister, but he was very progressive for the day. And he was very much, I can't even remember what, I think it was a Methodist church that he was a minister of, but he was more like a science of mind minister. And he just sort of walked into my life. And because he was a minister, he just goes to my daddy and says, you know, we really need her over at the church to help with the kids. And basically, he walks into my life without even knowing me, and him and his wife took me in, and I lived with them the last year that I was in school. And that was a true miracle, because I would not have lived that last year in my parents' house. And Herb and Donna Piper I had met Herb, I think, once or twice before that. And somehow or the other, he found out about the suicide attempt, and he went to my father, and he set this whole thing up. And so when I was 16, this man and his wife adopted me for a year, and she taught me to cook, and he got me really involved in, I left out a piece of another miracle. There was a guy at the Episcopal Church, a priest at the Episcopal Church, who was very recently there from California. And this was, like the late 60s, early 70s. And he was really, really hip. You know, we were podunk nowhere, North Carolina, and here's this priest from California. And he realizes immediately that what the high school kids need are dances. Well, everybody knew I loved to dance, so he immediately hooked up with me to get me. And through getting hooked up with him at the dances, he started doing these gatherings in the basement of the parish house where we were studying psychodrama and Gestalt therapy and Christian mystics. Mm. It saved my life because until he had me studying, I don't even remember the names, Paul, Gosh. Anyway, I used to know all that. Until then, I hated God. And I wasn't just trying to be an atheist. I was actively hating God. Until that summer where I was 16 and he introduced me to those Christian mystics. And I discovered that it wasn't Jesus. It wasn't Christianity that was the problem. Because these Christian mystics, everything they were saying, I'm like, hey, I'm there. I'm with that. I am down with that. That is good stuff. It's what's been done with it that I couldn't handle. Mm-hmm. So that was an incredible miracle. And so then it was shortly after that that I ran away and came back and then tried to kill myself. And then Don and Herb Piper adopted me for that year. And so Herb, of course, had all these books on Christian mystics, being the minister that he was. And so it was just one thing after another. And then, you know, lots of things happened. And there was about a three-year period where I was really involved in really, really intense, serious, heavy-duty drugs. Crystal meth, cocaine, heroin, all of that. I mean, and over and over and over and over again, people would get hurt. People would get arrested. I saw people die. And it was like I was invisible. It was like, I know there's a whole phalanx of guardian angels with purple hearts that have retired just watching over me for those 3 years. Because nothing ever happened to me. And I mean, literally, I walked away from scenes where people were, everybody getting arrested. And I just walked away. It was amazing. And then the whole near-death experience, of course, that was an absolute and utter miracle. Because that's when I understood for the first time ever that God does not stand in judgment of us. And I don't care how many people I talk to who want to argue that fact with me. Listen, I went there. I was gone. And we had the conversation. And I'm like, you know what? There was nothing but unconditional love and acceptance. And the only judgment going on when I left this life and was headed to the next, the only judgment going on was of me, by me, not from God. God was unconditionally loving, accepting. So God was in that near-death experience. I had this long conversation with, all I can do is say God. I don't know. It could have been an archangel. Could have been source. I don't know what to call it. But it seemed like God to me was not a person. It was a presence. It wasn't even an image. It was a presence and a feeling. And it was unconditionally loving and beautiful. And I asked every question I ever had about God and the devil, about good and bad, about life. And I felt like I got all my questions answered. To me, it seemed like we had at least a 10 or 12-hour conversation. Of course, that's not what happened because my brain still works, so I definitely wasn't gone that long. But it seemed like that. And that's when I gave up. Well, I'd actually already given up trying to be atheist a few years before that, but I was adamantly agnostic. Until that near-death experience. And then it was like, uh-oh. And so then that's when my spiritual study really began in earnest, was after that. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. And I don't want to belabor this, but I'd love to know if you can recall some of the questions that you ask the universe, the source,
yeah,
and some of the answers that you got.
Oh, I'd love to tell you that. One of the biggest ones was, and what was at the core of my depression, because I was severely, severely, severely clinically depressed from a very young age until my early 30s. And that depression came from shame. That depression came from shame. I just don't know a better way to say that. And so one of my biggest questions to God was, am I bad? Is something wrong with me? Am I flawed? You know, and if I am, why the hell am I living? You know, I mean, I was mad about it. Because when you die from a heroin overdose, let me tell you something. It is one of the most painful experiences you can ever have. It is like a heroin overdose is, I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. You are burning from the inside out, and you are itching. And it is like every blood cell in your body is on fire and itching at the same time. And if you could move, which you cannot, you would be scratching yourself raw because you itch. But you can't move. You can't move. And you are burning up and itching. It is a horrible, horrible experience. And so when I pulled away from that and left that body behind, believe me, I was happy to be gone. But my first words to God told me more about God and life than anything ever had to this point. And I can't even say those words on the radio because I'd probably get arrested. But I was so angry because when I left, you know, I'm in the hallway. I see the light. There's the door. I'm walking down the hallway. I'm getting ready to open the door. I am so happy to be going home. I am thrilled to be going home. And right when I put my hand on that doorknob to open that door and walk into that light and go back home, over here, this presence, this God, this amazing, loving, powerful energy says to me, you know, you still have work to do back there. And I turned around, and I won't tell you what I said, but it was not nice. I'm like, what the bleep, the dip, the bleep, I have to bleep and bop, bleep, bop. I mean, I had a little cussing temper tantrum right there at the door, walking in, because I didn't want to go back there. That was hell. My life had been hell to that point. And after I cussed the blue streak, I'm like, you mean I have to go back there? And God says to me, oh, no, you don't have to go back. That's your choice. You can go forward if you would like. I was just reminding you that there were decisions you made about things you wanted to accomplish. And because those were your decisions, you're going to do them. And so you can either go back and do them, or you can start all over, but you are going to do them. I'm like, I ain't starting that life over. Believe you me, there is no way I'm starting that life over. And it's like, well, and I'm like, you mean you're going to make me? And God's like, no, 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 honey. I'm not making you. It is your choice. You are the one who decided what you were going to do. I have nothing to say about that. Those were your decisions, and you will do what you said you were going to do because everyone does. And if you can't hang with that one this time, that's okay. Go ahead, go forward, and you'll just do it over until you do them. I'm like, no, I ain't doing it over. No. That was really the most profound thing, is to discover I had a choice, first of all. Second of all, I was not being judged for I was a heroin addict, okay? And I was cussing God right there in the hall, getting ready to go home. No judgment, just love. Just complete unconditional love and acceptance. That blew my mind because that's not what I expected. My image of God, even at that point, was of this sort of angry adolescent Zeus figure. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was really my image of God. But that was not my experience at all. God made it very clear to me, there is no judgment that comes from God. It's only us that judges us. There is a life review, believe me, I got to see it. There is a life review, and there is no judgment. There is only love, looking at it, and, you know, thinking about it, making decisions about it, deciding who to be with it. And I didn't have to do that whole thing because I didn't go all the way through. I just got shown a taste of it. But there were two or three really major things. One was, God does not judge us. We judge ourselves enough. We don't need God doing that. God is unconditionally loving. God accepts us exactly as we are. It didn't matter that I was a heroin addict. It didn't matter that I came in cussing. I am already saved. That's what I got told. I am already saved. That has already been taken care of. Whew. What a relief. The other really major thing is, for me, was everybody, I can't remember the words that was used to say this, And now I'm going to use somebody else's words because I've heard it so many times in so many other ways. But basically, we're all doing the best that we can do. Mm-hmm. And that's why there is no judgment from God, because God sees all, and that we're all doing the best that we can do. And as soon as we can do better, we do better. But until we can, we're doing the best we can. And so I just learned a lot about, oh, and the other was willingness. That's where I really understood the thing about willing. God explained to me, because I ask it in about 16 different ways, what's the trick? What's the secret? How do I stop being so miserable? Why do I feel like dirt, crap, dreadful all the time? Why am I so miserable? And the answer always came back to what I'm focused on and the willingness to let something else. The willingness to love, the willingness to forgive, the willingness to let go. God talked to me a lot about willingness. But mostly it was about love, and to tell you the truth, I didn't understand it. At the time, I didn't understand the conversation about love because I had never really felt. I mean, I loved life, and I loved people, and I loved the woods, but I had never actually felt personally loved. That was the first time that I actually felt personally loved. But I'll tell you what was even more astonishing than the near-death experience itself is when I woke up from that.
Tell us about that.
Lordy. When I woke up, I remembered the whole thing. And I just laid there in bed because I knew if I get up, I'm going to go right over to that drawer and I'm going to run up heroin again. And I don't want to run up heroin again. And so I don't know what to do. I'm just going to lay here in the bed till something happens. And I started praying. And it might have been the first time I prayed since I was a child. I don't know. But I started praying, you know, God, I don't want to do heroin no more. But I know if I get up out of this bed, because I had to walk by the drawer where everything was to get to the bathroom. And I'd been doing heroin for about 9 months or a year at this point. And I had a pretty intense habit. I was running up 6-10 times a day. And I knew if I get up and go past that drawer, I'm going to run. I'm going to do it. And I'm like, God, I don't know what to do. All I know to do is just lay here in the bed. Because I don't want to do heroin no more. And you got to do something, because I can't walk past that and not do it. I know that. And so I laid there in that bed for about 4 hours, and I had to go to the bathroom so bad. I mean, I was starting to get desperate. And all of a sudden, it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and this whole thing had happened maybe 6 or something anyway. Comes a pounding and a banging on my front door. I'm like, what in the world? And I just decided to ignore it. Next thing I know, I hear my mother screaming her head off for me to open that door. Well, now you have to understand, I hadn't even talked to my mom in 3 months, first of all. Second of all, my mama did not know where I lived. Third of all, I did not have a telephone. How did my mama even find my house is the fourth question, which she never answered, by the way. But when I heard my mother start screaming, I knew she wouldn't stop. I knew pretty soon the police are going to come, because the neighbors are going to be very upset that there is this woman pounding and screaming on my door. So I finally get up and I open the door, and I weighed maybe 96, 94 pounds. You could see every bone in my body. My mama takes one look at me and says, you look like this. She says, get your stuff, you're coming with me. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm not. I mean, I couldn't think of a worse thing. Well, she said, oh, yes, you are. And she went and got a bag and started throwing stuff in it. Well, then I had to help her because I'm afraid what drawer she's going to open. And then she would have killed me dead right there herself if she had seen all that stuff. My mother took me that day, and I'm asking her the whole time, how'd you find me? How'd you know where I was? I followed my nose. I'm like, what does that mean? Well, she cussed me out. She was so mad, and she picked me up at the top of the mountain. We were driving down the mountain, and she pulls over about halfway down the mountain, and she turns around. She shakes her finger at me, and she said, let me tell you something, girl. The next time you decide to die, if you don't want me to come get you, then don't come ask me to.
Wow.
I'm like, whoa.
Wow.
I don't remember doing that. And so I went to my mom's and I got clean off heroin. And I didn't know, of course, that you could die, get, you know, going cold turkey off heroin, thank God. And she just let me rip her middle room up, and I ripped mattresses in half, and I got clean. And I quit heroin cold turkey, and I never did it again. Even though I went back and lived in that same situation and still did other drugs, I never did heroin again after that. But that was an incredible miracle. I mean, that miracle in and of itself of my mom, because I didn't do that. I didn't go get my mama. I don't do anything. God did that. God went and got my mom.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. And she came and found me. Mm-hmm. And to the day she died, she would never admit that there was any way that she had of finding me. She just, all she ever said was, I followed my nose. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Louisa, that story really touched me. And I want to spend the last part of this interview talking about the way out. Now, you went to the depths of hell.
Yes, I did. Over and over.
And you were brought out.
Yep.
And so for people who are listening today who may not be facing a heroin addiction, but something in their lives is creating distress and dis-ease, worry. Let's talk about how to come out. Before the break, we were talking about our beliefs are causing our suffering.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And let's go back to that.
Okay.
And lay out a plan, a pathway for coming out of the misery, of the suffering.
All right.
Okay.
I'm going to say one thing to that. That's why I'm doing this radio show. Because the way out is in. The way out is knowing that God is inside of you. That, yes, God is transcendent. God is everywhere and everything all around. But God is also immanent. God, that means God is in us. And that's the only way out. I'll tell you, folks, right now, we can talk about it in 17 different ways. But the only way out is in. And we are talking today about little pieces, I guess, of my spiritual journey with my good friend, Reverend Audrey DePue. How you doing, Audrey?
Still thriving over here.
Still thriving. And so far, we've been having a good time. I hope you've been enjoying it. Before we went on that last little break, Audrey had said we were going to come back and do something, but of course, I don't remember what that something was, so we're going to let her tell us.
We're going to talk about the way out.
The way out.
Of whatever it is that's making us feel bound and, and not free and troubled. But I wanted to tell you a story that I read in Charlotte Joko Beck's book called Everyday Zen.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's a long story, but I'm going to try to give you the two-minute version.
Okay.
There's this young man named Fred. Actually, his name was Mushin. And he wanted to grow spiritually, and he was reading some books, but he was very bitter on the inside, and on his job he was causing problems, and he got fired because of all of the dissent and things that were happening on his work. So he came home to tell his wife that he got fired, and she had left him a note and said, Mushin, I can't stand this anymore. I'm gone. And so he was sitting there, lost his job, lost his wife, and he thought to himself, there's one thing I do want. I want to be enlightened. So he went down to the bookstore, and he found this book, How to Catch the Train of Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
So he came home, and he read the book, and it had instructions, with directions on how to get enlightened. He read it, and he decided to go for it. He gave up his apartment. He packed up his valuables in his backpack, put his book in there, and took another book with him, and he went down to the train station because he was going to catch the train to enlightenment. So now he sat down there for three days, and nothing happened. The train didn't come. The fourth day, he hears the roar of the engine. train is coming. Train came right by him, swoosh, didn't stop and kept going. He said, I better go back and read this book again. So he read the book again, and he was trying to be prepared so when that train stopped, he could get on that train.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the book became popular, and then a few other people showed up down there at the train station. They wanted to be enlightened also. And but every time the train came by, it wouldn't stop. It just kept going. But they didn't give up. They were all reading the book and determined they were going to find the way to enlightenment. Well, after a while, there were 30 to 40 people down there at the train station. And Mushin said, and some of the people had brought their children. So Mushin noticed that the children weren't being taken care of by the parents because the parents were busy watching for the train.
Uh-huh.
So Mushin went in his backpack, gave the kids some of his nuts and raisins and fruit that he had in his backpack. And then he realized that wasn't going to be enough, so he went and planted a garden. Then some teenagers showed up, and you know you've got to have something for teenagers to do. So he had the teenagers to help him with the garden. Became a very profitable business, that garden down there. But he felt comfortable that the children were being taken care of. But he was also bitter because he was not able to watch for the train like he wanted to. But he kept on taking care of the children, and more people showed up, so he had to build an addition to the train depot so folks could have a place to sleep. And he did that, and still, he couldn't get, every time the train would come, he wouldn't be down there, and the train didn't stop anyway. Now, finally, what they figured out was that there were other people at the next train station. There were people down there waiting for the train. And because Mushin had developed quite an efficient community, he went down to the next train station to show those people how to build a community. Then he went down to the third train station. All the whiles, using his energy to take care of the people and not being able to watch for the train. So now I'm going to just shorten this a little bit. What happened was Mushin grew very old, and he still was interested in catching the train, but not as interested as before because he had a second book in his backpack, and that book was taught him how to sit in meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And he started sitting, and some of the people around him started sitting. At first they would sit once a day. Then he kept reading further in the book, and it showed him how to sit for two or three days at a time. And he got to the point where those things that he worried about, those things that he was troubled about, those things no longer mattered. And he started feeling peace. Now I'm going to cut to the chase now. Now he's an old man, gray-haired. He's been at the train station. He's been, he has run this community for many, many years. And he's seen people come and people go. The train has never stopped. One night he was sitting in meditation, and he had this thought, I'm going to sit all night. And he sat all night. And when daybreak came, he heard the train. The train started coming down the track, came right up to where he was, slowed down. Mushin sat there, looked at the train, and he realized that he didn't have to get on that train. That actually he was the train. That what he had been looking for, the enlightenment that he had been looking for, he had found.
Hmm.
And so I want to talk about how the way out, you said the way out is to get in touch with the source within.
Yeah.
In my Baptist background, it would be to have a personal encounter with the Lord Jesus Christ. However you say it,
right,
we have to make that connection.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Mushin and what is it that he found through his experience of waiting on that train.
I think he found that the way to God is inside.
Mm-hmm.
He found out that the way to enlightenment is living what's in your heart, doing what matters to you, doing what feeds your soul. And, you know, he had an idea about enlightenment. He had an idea about catching a train. But in truth, what really mattered to him is that them children were fed. What really mattered to him is that there was community. What really mattered to him is that people knew how to take care of themselves and take care of each other. And he was the one who knew how to make sure that that happened. And that gives me chills thinking about it. Because what that says is he was living enlightenment. And that's why at a point when the train came, he realized, you know, I don't need to go get that. I already got it. I already got it. And that's what inner divinity is. It's not outside of us. It is, you know, and in psychology, I forgot which branch I first heard this, but I remember it in grad school that, you know, you can't go around your emotions. You got to go through them, you know. And then certain meditation teachers will tell you you can't stop a thought. You can just think something else. It's like you hear this same thing every which way, and it all comes down to exactly what he just experienced, that the only way to is through, you know? You gotta go into it in order to come out the other side. So what Mushin did was he lived his purpose, which was clearly to teach and to support and to make sure people were taken care of. He could see what needed to be done, and he did it. And to me, that's God showing up. That is what it means to live your truth, is you do what matters to you. Because what matters to you and to you and to you and to you may not be what matters to somebody else. We're each individual. We each have free will. And so the way out is in. If you go into your own heart deep enough, what you are going to discover is that it's limitless and there's God there. If you sit where, whether it's in meditation or whether it's focusing on your breath, or if you go inside of a feeling even, and you just keep noticing it and going in it and going in it and going in it and quit telling stories about it and just go in it and go in it, you're just going to come out the other side, because that's all there is. Is there the stuff that's going on in our mind, and then there's the reality of God. And if we go far enough in, we find that reality of God. And so it's funny, because when you started talking about Mushin, I thought, well, boy, he sounds a lot like me. Because I read everything that was available to be read, especially after that near-death experience. I studied every world religion. I studied every tribal religion. I studied goddess, Wiccan, pagan stuff. I studied all New Age, what I now call New Age woo-woo. I studied everything there was to study, because I was trying to find something that actually spoke to me, that I could actually belong to. Like, oh, this is it. This is for me. And you know what? I would take a little bit of it, but the rest of it was not for me. And I learned and I learned and I learned and I learned and I learned. And then finally what I realized is it's not about learning. It's about opening your heart. It's about getting quiet enough to feel your own self. And what actually brought me up and out of that severe depression was when I actually accepted that God lives inside of me, when I actually experience that divinity inside of me. And when I did, it actually felt like I existed for the first time in my life. I existed in a way I never had before. And I hadn't felt that connection since I was a little kid sitting in the woods. And that happened for me in my early 30s, I think. And the minute I really felt that connection, that severe depression was gone. Mm-hmm. Not that I don't still deal with depression, because that's sort of my tendency. If things are going wrong, I tend to get, you know, I'm a moody person. But I have never, ever been depressed like I was depressed for 30 years since I had that experience of God inside of me. Because if you can touch that, if you can know that, it's hard to be depressed. Because that is what that connection is. I mean, you can call it unconditional love. You can call it light. You can call it, I mean, there's all kinds of beautiful things you can call it. You can call it Jesus Christ. You can call it Mary, which a lot of Catholics that I've worked with, when they tap into their higher self, their inner divinity, it's Mary. And I think that's wonderful. It's like, if you feel that divinity inside of you, it gives you ground to walk upon. It gives you a way out. So that would be the short answer, is the way out is in. How does each person do that? I'm going to go back to what I said before. The first step always is the willingness to let go, whatever it is, and to notice that so far you hadn't been willing. And so to notice if you could be willing to be willing to let it go. Not knowing how. You don't need to know how. We do not need to know how. It has been promised in every spiritual tradition throughout. Believe me, I've read them all, and it says it in every one of them. If you will just take the step in front of you, then the next step will be shown. Most people don't get to see the whole path. I'm very sorry, everybody, because for years I raised Cain about that. I wanted to know the whole path before I took that first step. Well, if that's what you're going to do, you ain't never going to move, because that's not what's promised. But what is promised is if you will take the first step, if you will take the step in front of you, then the next step will be shown. That's one definition of faith, I suppose. But that's the way it works. And so that's all we ever have to do, is be willing to let go whatever it is that's been troubling us, and to be willing to believe that we're going to exist without it. That's the problem in every addiction. You don't think you can live without it. And it doesn't matter whether you're addicted to heroin, or whether you're addicted to being overweight, or whether you're addicted to another person, or whether you're addicted to some disease that you've been calling yourself by. You don't have an identity without it. And until you're willing to believe that you will exist without it, you can't let it go. It's not going to happen. So I'll just say that once more. The way out is in. Mm-hmm. And the method is willingness.
Willingness to let go.
Willingness to let go whatever the suffering has been, and the willingness to believe that you can live without it. That's it. We're going to have to wrap this up, Miss Audrey. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
You made talking about my crazy life interesting, for me at least, and fun. I don't even think I cried once. I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as we did. And I want to remind everybody that we are here every Wednesday at WAIF Cincinnati, 88.3 FM on your radio dial, and live streaming online at WAIF883.org. The show is Inner Divinity, Knowing the Source Within, and there is a Facebook page by that name that you are welcome to join, and let me know what you want to hear about, and let me know if you want to share your stories on the radio. You can also feel free to contact me through my websites or email, again, which is just my name, louisadyer.com, or through the Facebook page for this show. I want to thank Miss Reverend Audrey DePue again for a wonderful day. Wherever we are, Source is there with us. God is there with us. That at the very core of who you are, Source energy burns brightly. Otherwise, you wouldn't be living. Source energy is what makes our hearts beat and our souls dance. And here's Faith to tell you all about it from her Suncatcher CD, God Is. Enjoy, and I'll see you back here next week.